This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network, presented by Adam and Sue. In the past on Allegro Non Troppo, when we have done a show on this theme, which is death, we have advised the listener who is terminally ill or is about to or has had someone close to them die, they might be better off not to listen.
Death is a difficult subject because we make it difficult.
Everyone listening to this show today is going to die. Eventually, some of you are going to die soon.
There are two types of death situations. We'll talk about encroaching death from disease or deterioration and death by sudden trauma.
The idea of how we approach death is as important as how we approach life. The evolution in thinking about this process has come a long way.
Some of the ideas we are going to discuss in the show may be distressing, but it actually might be a good idea to listen. It may help you confront and identify your own issues.
There are some radical new thoughts about the immediate and post-death position for families and partners.
Joining us today on Allegro Non Troppo to discuss these issues are
Trish Ayres, who is a grief and bereavement counsellor, and Peter Robertson, who is the manager of CG Moody and Daughter Funeral Directors. Trish and Peter, welcome to Allegro Non Troppo.
Thank you.
And thanks, Adam.
Now, what we've done in the past is we have advised the listener who may be facing a position of death or immediate death or somebody around them not to listen. But look, I'm actually changing my view on this. And if you are facing any of these issues, it might actually be a good idea to listen. It's not going to be easy for you. For the listener who has a particular issue regarding death coming up or just immediately past, but it might help. So my advice, which has been usually don't listen, perhaps you should. If you find it all too distressing,
then just turn the radio down for a little while. But I do believe that if we get these messages across, then people aren't so scared and so frightened.
It's the fact that there's this conspiracy of silence in our community about death that's really, really part of the problem, I think. We don't talk about death terribly much. Trish, as a grief counsellor, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about this. Why there seems to be this polarisation in the community. People tend to stay away from or are frightened to talk about death.
I think because it's such an unknown process. If somebody is terminally ill, it's unknown how long that person is going to be ill for, what's going to happen, how the friends and relatives are going to cope. And if it's sudden, well, people don't tend to talk about sudden death, that somebody might have an accident. So I think there is a conspiracy of silence around death and the dying process.
And there is a polarisation as well that happens, because when people are under sort of acute care when they're coming into a end-of-life situation, they're suddenly removed a lot from their own environment. They're put in a completely different environment. They're put in intensive care or acute care. And that makes the dying experience so much more alienated for the people and for who are dying and for the family as well. I'm wondering, is it best for people to die in their own homes?
I think, look, there's a lot of people today who do choose to die in their own home surrounded by family and friends, and I think it's an individual choice. I don't think that there's any, you know, way that this should be done. It's up to the people and the family and the medical people helping with dealing with the illness that's there. And the palliative care today and the nurses that attend palliative care at home are excellent. They are excellent. They're fantastic. They really help someone die with dignity. They support the nurse, the family, and some people find that's a much better way for them to die.
I think there's a great fear of dying alone and for our loved ones to be alone when they die. My grandfather died in a nursing home, and it was my first question, was there somebody with him? And I, having gone through other grieving processes, I had a son who died, I felt it was kind of, it's a strange word, but it's an honour to be there at that moment when somebody you love dies. It's the rite of passage, I guess.
It's a life-changing experience. I've been with a few people while they've died. I actually, I don't know whether I was fortunate or not, I was actually looking into somebody's eyes at the moment of death.
Wow.
And that was, she actually became conscious just for a moment. And I looked right into her eyes at that moment of death, and that it's quite chilling. But there was just this sudden recognition. She recognised who I was, and then she died at that moment. And that was quite a powerful experience.
Is that a common experience for people going through grief? Have they said that there's that moment they were sure they were looking, or they were sure they knew who they were?
I think a lot of people do experience that. It's so varied, really, when people die. And I've been with a person when they actually died, my auntie. I was very close to her, and she went through a protracted, long death, and it was agonising for the family. And when she actually died, I was there right with her at the time, and she kind of had a little bit of peace before she died, and then she just died, and that was it. And it was a relief for everyone, really, and a great relief for her.
And that brings into the whole trauma, doesn't it? If there's a trauma accident, you don't probably have that moment compared to a long-suffering illness or something That's you right. know that might be coming.
We might ask Peter in on this for a moment. Peter Robertson, as you're an undertaker, this particular process, the process of death, is there a moment of death? Do you think? Is there a particular time we can say this is the moment of death?
No, look, I don't think there really is. In every death, there's a different situation and there's a different form of loss and feeling with any grieving family, especially families going back to the palliative care situation. I've been in the industry, in the funeral industry, for 16 years, and especially in the last probably 8 years, there's a huge swing to people to be able to go home in that care situation surrounded by a family, which brings in a whole new concept of someone having to farewell a loved one.
I see. Because there are millions and millions of death certificates issued, and on a death certificate they say the moment of death is X. And that's one thing, that when is actually the moment of death?
When the doctor actually signs the medical certificate of death.
So that's legally the moment of death.
Absolutely. Yes.
Now, I wonder, let's explore this, because we have two highly qualified professionals here on this subject. Let's explore this moment of death. Is the moment of death when the person draws their last breath? Is it when the heart stops? Is it when they get a flat line on the brain activity? Yet, after that, all of that's happened, the body and the cells in the body still perform movement and reflex for several hours. It takes 6 hours for the body to stop all movement, rigor mortis. What do you think, Trish, is the moment of death?
I don't think you can say there's one moment of death because of all the things that you've just been talking about. I think, look, it depends on, people could say, look, my person died when they were comatose and they could no longer respond to me. And we decided to donate their organs, and then the person was kept alive. So a person could make that decision themselves at that time. Or it could be when the doctor comes in to see the person and certifies that there's no life in the person, their heart has stopped, their breathing stopped, and the doctor signs a paper and says the person is dead at that stage. I think, you know, I don't know that you can put it down to one point that a person is dead at this particular point, because is it spiritual? Is it physiological? Is it psychological? When is it?
You just raised a very important point, because physical death, if there's organ donation, that sort of denies physical death straight away, because it's sort of prolongation of life through another means. Peter, I just wanted to ask you, as an undertaker, have you actually been with people when they've died?
Yes, I've been called to several homes to make arrangements where the person is just about to pass away, where they might have pre-arranged a funeral, especially if it's maybe family we've done work for, or even relatives and friends. They have sort of got us into the home when someone has sort of passed away while we're there.
Okay. Because you're not attached to the family, what's it like? Is there some sort of sudden focal point at the point of death? Is there a sense of release and relief?
I think with a family, even though they might know that death is definitely going to happen, I think until it happens, no one really is prepared for it. They might have been home in palliative care or in a hospital for 6 or 7 months, but until it actually happens, although they think they're prepared, they're not. I think as soon as a death or someone is pronounced dead or someone has just passed away, it's a whole different scenario with the family than what it was until that moment they did pass away.
I think going through that situation myself, there was that impending doom.
Yes.
And when it came, and that was one journey in itself. And then there was the announcement of death and so forth, and that was another sort of journey. And then there was the somebody coming into my home with an album showing me coffins and urns and things. And that in itself was yet another stage, and that was quite confronting, having someone come in and it was like a photo album, and it, as right. you would, and have that person going through, and you've just in this ultimate moment of grief where you've just, your body actually physically can't breathe anymore almost, and someone showing you a photo album.
What we normally do, to, depending on the circumstance of a death, I deal with a lot of the funeral service. I've conducted a teenage suicide. We seem to get a lot of that. It really depends on the cause of death. If it's sudden, a car accident, a murder, or anything like that, it's a whole different mental approach to it. But if someone's been nursing their loved one, their mother, their partner or father at home for a certain period of time, it's a whole different scenario again. So in each cause of death or each situation, it's really a totally different feeling. It's we have to be in a totally different mode for different sort of situations, so we've got to be fairly adaptable to the situation, what has caused the death, because we're the first basically there after, whether it's the family, the police or whoever's been involved, we're the next step. So,
and that's a kind of the realization of death, these processes. It's not at that moment when the doctor says, you know, I'm sorry, they just actually have to look at you. It's that person walking into your home, it's that person doing that next step for you. You realize that there's no going back.
So the process of death comes at different, it's stage by stage.
I think so.
And each of those stages then, I would assume, will bring with it its own challenges and its own things that we have to face. Let's just talk a moment. We've been talking about people being prepared and ready for death. I'd just like to talk to both of you, Peter and Trish, about death by trauma and perhaps a little bit about death by suicide. I didn't want to really dwell on that. But death by trauma, where somebody's suddenly just not expecting somebody to die and it happens, that is probably one of the hardest things to deal with, Trish, for people.
I think that it is. I think especially a suicide death is a really, it's just shattering and devastating and usually unexpected for the family, and it's a particular sort of death that can take years and years and years for people to be able to integrate that this has happened. And people go through a lot of extreme processes after there's been a suicide. People can become very unwell themselves. There is an increased risk of any people in the family suiciding as a result of what's happened. It's a very difficult death, yes, for people to deal with.
Oh, my goodness. Peter, do you get many suicide?
Yeah, yes, look, we've actually done 3-in-1 family, just as you were saying before. Yes, well, look, there was a lot, suicide's a thing too, that it's out there happening a lot more than what people even realise. It's not in the papers. You might just read that someone's sort of jumped off a bridge or something like that, or shot themselves. But it happens every day of the week.
Then why do you think that is? Why do you think that we don't discuss suicides, or it's not?
Well, look, I think a lot of it's peer group pressure. A lot of people really don't want to talk about their inner emotions to people, especially with males. It's very high. It's a blokey thing not to discuss anything, or they don't want to go to their mates to have a chat.
Then how does that come into you coming into their homes with suicide people and as a counsellor as well, that you're coming into this air where it's not discussed and all of a sudden you're in there?
I probably feel a little bit more comfortable with that for the simple reason I've been through that situation myself with somebody, with a partner. So it's a very, very... It's a very... something that's got to be touched with softly, with kid gloves, I guess you'd say, and walking into a home where a young person especially has something's happened, there's a lot of confrontation immediately in the family. I've seen families destroyed by a teenage suicide in the family. But it's just something that you've got to be very, very aware of the situation and the people's emotions. Because sometimes when we get called to a home and we don't know any of the situation, we don't know the circumstances, we don't know anything. So we're walking into something that could be a volatile situation.
Trish, as when this happens and there's an unexpected suicide or trauma death, can you give us a few ideas of some of the practical things people might be able to do to cope?
You mean the family?
Mm.
I don't think there's anything you can say that how can the family cope with something like that. They just have to take one day at a time, 1 hour at a time to try and, in the initial stages, just deal with what they have to deal with, which is the identification of the body and the funeral, organising the funeral, telling people, all that sort of thing is the first thing that people have to do. But, you know, after a suicide, people need an enormous amount of support because it's a death that is not talked about a lot. There's a lot of stigma attached to suicide. And in general, people may not get the support that they need when there's been a suicide in the family.
Because quite often people blame themselves in a suicide, don't they? The mother or the father says it's my fault and the sister says it's my fault and so forth.
Indeed. You're listening to Allegra and On Chopper with Adam and Sue. Our special guests today are Trish and Robert. We're talking about death. As we said at the start of the show, and I'll just reiterate this for people if you've just tuned in, we're talking about death and dying and about the issues and aspects that go with that. If you have had somebody close to you die or is about to die or death has touched your life and you're having trouble coping with this, I've normally said don't listen, but I think it might actually be a good idea if you did listen because confronting and facing death is probably one of the best ways to get over it. Now, death by trauma and suicide is different to a planned and sustained suffering death. I'm just interested, Trish and Peter, you read everywhere that there's no need for people to suffer a lingering death through pain anymore. Is that right? Do you know?
I think that the palliative care today is outstanding. The palliative care's job is to help people live their life as long as, well, until they die. So live a good life until they die. And also to not hasten death but not delay death either. So really palliative care and medication, and I'm not a medical practitioner so this is not my area, but medication is to try and keep people out of pain, and that's the whole idea of palliative care really.
It's an ongoing, very difficult issue. Palliative care brings with it its own problems because usually people are so doped up that they don't really know. And the communication with people who are dying is a really important aspect. And we need to understand how to communicate with people when they're dying and what we need to do and what people with who are dying, what they need to do as well. It's all a very complicated process. Now, we've had Sue and I and Peter in particular, well, I think we've all had some experiences with death here. Mm. I just wanted to talk a moment before we do our other jobs. It's about communication with dying people. Now, Sue, you had a child, a very young child, so there was no communication.
There was not. My son was born at 29 weeks. And he was premature with it, and he had a condition called diaphragmatic hernia. So there was a 50-50 chance that he would survive, but I was thrust into this world and I had to learn very, very quickly. And all of a sudden I had to go through the grieving of having a child who obviously didn't come to, you know, the full term and all that. And then I had to come to terms with losing him. And it was about, and people were saying, well, you know, well, just tell us what you want. Oh, I can't even breathe. I can't tell you what I want. And it was very hard for me to control that communication within my family.
Peter, communication with people before they die, do you get that as an undertaker? Do people tell you what they want?
Absolutely. Many a time we'll go into a hospital and sit down and do the arrangement with the family there and the person that's about to pass away. Sometimes that can be actually a very good thing too, because the person that's going to pass away is, you know, he's usually in fairly high spirits. He's got his family there and the funeral director. So there's sort of lots and lots of jokes made. And they can be quite a stimulating arrangement, a funeral arrangement, because the whole family's involved. The person's going to pass away is involved. And they all think that it's, you know, pretty incredible because, like, you know, we've got our funeral director here.
I actually didn't know that went on, to be honest.
Absolutely.
I didn't know. I thought, no, I'm sorry, you get called later. You're the guy who turns up later. I had no idea that you could actually call somebody in. I thought you just called in the priest.
No, not at all. Sometimes they will give you the last rites and the last prayer, but we're in actually even before the priest sometimes. And so the arrangements are put in place. Usually it could be a fortnight before, 6 weeks before, it could be 2 days before. But they can be quite interesting, actually. And you'll find that the families, too, because they're there and the person that's going to pass away there, there's just so much involvement with everybody.
Trish, we have to do a little break, but when we come back, we might talk to you as a grief counsellor about communication with dying people, because there's a terrible stigma in community and society about talking to people who are dying. People are terribly uncomfortable about going and talking to people about death and things like this. I mean, I had some experiences myself going in to see friends who were terminally ill, and when you walk in to visit them and they're sitting there crying, oh my God, what am I going to do? So we'll talk about that. You're listening to the Community Radio Network across Australia. Today we're talking about death and dying, and our special guests in the show are Peter Robertson from C.G. Moody and Daughter, funeral directors, and Trish Ayres, who is a counsellor for grief and... Is it grief and dying, Trish?
No, it's grief and bereavement.
Grief and bereavement. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about... death and dying and how it affects communities and societies and families and people. And we've been talking about the discomfort that happens when somebody has been told that they're going to die. There's this, all of a sudden it becomes very difficult for people to approach them, Trish.
Look, it does. And I think a lot of that is about, firstly, people just don't know what to say, because they go and they think, what am I going to say to this person? But really, it's an opportunity to see the person, to even get rid of some negative stuff that's happened between you. It's an opportunity to be really real with this person. But it depends on the relationship. It might just be a friend, a distant friend or a distant relative who is going to die. And it's a wonderful time. It can be a very healing time for a lot of people in their relationships to be able to just have some communication with someone who's dying. But people generally are afraid because they don't know what to say. They don't know, you know, what to bring up. They don't know what to talk about in the conversation.
Sometimes it's just, like you said, it's important to be there. I had a neighbour who didn't know what to say or do, and he mowed the lawns. He just came over, he mowed the lawns, and he went away again. He didn't ask for thanks. And I think some people do come in, and you have to assume their grief in a way. They're trying to support you, but what you end up doing is supporting them. So sometimes it's just good to be there.
It is just good to be there. And sometimes sitting with someone who's dying, it can just be sitting in silence. It can just be holding their hand. It can just be wiping their forehead or getting them something that they need. Sometimes you don't have to have any words. You can just be there, and your very presence there is supporting them.
I think sometimes the words actually get in the way, because then you start analysing somebody who's going through grief. You start analysing, well, what do they mean by that?
But the prospect of losing one's loved ones can be a terrifying experience, really, when you know somebody's going to die around you. It produces a lot of anxiety, leading to both dependence on the people around you, and also the person who's dying, they might be defensive and fear rejection. You know, if they talk to anybody or people come see them, they're going to be rejected by the people around them because they can't face the fact that they're going to die. And that compounds all of the issues. You were saying before that there's almost no way, no practical advice you can give to people to cope with death in trauma. But when you know somebody's going to die and it's coming up, particularly for the person who's dying, it's terribly difficult to say to them, look, this is what you need to do so that people won't be afraid of you, because people are afraid of the person that's dying, aren't they?
I think it's not being afraid of the person who's dying. I think it's afraid of knowing what's the right thing to say. And also talking with a person who's dying makes us have to confront our own death, because we think about it, and we think about, what if that was me, or what if that was, you know, my very close loved one? How would I cope with that? What would I do? What would I say? So I think for the dying person just has to be who they are and do what they want to do and say what they want to do, what they want to say. And I think in dying, look, there's so many ups and downs. People can be able to talk one day, they can't talk another day, they can be angry another day, they might be in silence another day. It's taking a person how they are, accepting them totally how they are at that time.
And that's, I believe, that grief, they say there's seven stages of grief. For me, I think that's a bit rubbish, because there's not just one stage. You go, okay, I'm going to go that step now, I'm going to go that step. You actually retreat through all of those feelings. So it's different for everybody at every different stage, isn't it?
It's totally different. And I think there's no blueprint for how we die or how we grieve the loss of somebody. Everybody's process is entirely different. It depends on the person, depends on the relationship with the person. It depends on lots of things in their life prior to that. And I think that, you know, with the grieving people, people grieve in their own time. People will do the grieving that they need to do, and it takes as long as it takes.
Do you find that the person dying is going, I don't know whether this is an odd question, but are they going through a sense of grief for themselves? Are they grieving for the life that they would have had, or are they grieving for something they should be doing or saying? Or
I think all of those things can happen. I think they can be worried about their family, how their family are going to survive, what's going to happen, how will their partner be without them, are they going to be okay financially, what happens with all the funeral, expenses and the financial side of life after they've gone. There can be all of that, and there can be lots of other things. There can be not wanting to be in pain. There can be their own personal grief about loss of life that they don't want to leave yet. They still want to be alive and live and do things. So it's a myriad of experiences that a person would have.
Peter, when communicating with dying people for The Undertaker,
yes,
you would have had a lot of experience with this, with people coming to you to tell you about their dying experience. Some people would be quite with it, and then other people are probably off their face on painkillers, so they're not. Have you had much communication and discourse with people just prior to death about their funeral?
Absolutely. You'll find that people that come in to pre-arrange or will go to their home or, as I said again, to their hospital, even though that they know that they're in their last days, they're fairly switched on of what they want. They've got a very open mind and they don't seem to have any fear of death whatsoever. They're quiet, can be very complacent about it also, they can. And they try and make it more of a celebration service rather than what we call a funeral service. They're sort of in some way pleased that they have an input into their own funeral, because you'll see so many people that come and say, now this is what I want, or when they pre-arrange or pre-pay funeral, don't let my daughter change or don't let my son change it. This is what I want, and it's just quite interesting to see the little nuts and bolts of how people make up or put in place in their own funeral service when they have an input into it.
All right. Did you want to say something?
I was just saying how interesting it is. I can't imagine myself going, okay, I'm going to plan for my funeral now. I would like these balloons and that balloons, and I would like red serviettes and so forth. It's quite it's an alternate concept, isn't it, really?
It's something now, too, that we encourage, too, especially families, their grandchildren. We make sure that we try and get everyone involved so no one's left out. We give them all sorts of different people. A lot of people have funerals at home now. They have them in the backyard, they have them on the beach. I've done them on boats. I've done one in a plane. It's just becoming, there's just so many options. And a lot of people too these days are getting away from sort of the, you know, we're stepping outside the square a little bit, I suppose, with the way that they want their life celebrated or their loved one's life celebrated, which I think is absolutely fantastic.
See, that's two things I've learned, Adam.
Do you have to have a funeral?
No, you don't. I'm not having one. I'm going to be thrown off the back of my yacht out at sea, and that's it.
Is that true? Is that you want to be buried at sea?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you're not having a funeral? That's quite...
No, not at all.
It's alternative.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's quite interesting coming from an undertaker who doesn't want to have a funeral.
Yeah. So there's all lots and lots and lots and lots of different... different ways now of saying goodbye, and I think it's very, very good that I think a lot more people now are a lot more aware. I remember I lost my father when I was 9, my brother was 3 months old, and my sister was 12. Back then, which is a few years ago, people didn't go, or children didn't go to the funeral service. My mother today, and mum's 87, I hope I've got that right because she's listening, She said the biggest mistake she ever made in her whole life with us kids was not taking them to Dad's funeral. And that's because it was a bit taboo then. But look, you'll find now that at funeral services, I did a very, very, very large funeral 2 weeks ago for a teacher. All the children from the college were there. Everyone sort of that they could involve in it, which they did. And I think that's a very, very important factor. Involve everyone that had some sort of connection with that person or with the family.
We're just, sorry, Adam, but this is really interesting. Somebody's texting and it's really interesting because the family's saying for your departure that they don't have anything then to go to.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's something that I'm working over now with my family and my mother. I understand exactly where you come from. It's just something personal. I love the scene. It's something that I want.
I was going to say, Peter, that what about having a celebration when you do go off the back of the boat, that your friends, your family can be there? Well, because in terms of death, it's really important for people to be able to have ritual
absolutely,
and
but
memory.
I've got that covered. I'm going to have my wake before I die.
Oh, pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to take this conversation to a slightly different level now and look at something which is a bit more contentious about the death and dying process. I've been doing some research about this and looking at some of the trends and things that are happening overseas, because we tend to import a lot of the ideas that are happening, particularly in America, where they seem to be on the fringe of obsession with just about everything. And one of the things they're doing now, or they're suggesting, is that people who have family who die unexpectedly or expectedly or in a situation of trauma where they're able to, that families be involved in the undertaking process. This is not just the arranging of the funeral. This is the preparing the body, draining the fluids and doing everything and helping the morticians get the bodies ready for the funeral service. Now, I almost went white when I read that, but that's my own personal response. Is this a valid and is it a realistic or is it just morbid and horrible? Peter, perhaps as an undertaker you can answer this for us.
No, look, I don't think it's morbid and horrible at all. There's a certain time where families will come in after we've done our preparation, and there's no need to go into that because you've covered that.
Well, that's when you fill up all the body cavities and drain the fluids.
Well, once all that's been done.
Yeah.
Or an embalming's been done. We then, the family, we get it a lot of times now, especially if a mother's lost a young son. In some different ethnic communities, it's part of their custom to come in and dress their loved one. Where they'll come in, they'll then sponge the body down. They will dress the body. One of the girls I've got who works for me, who's a makeup artist, and does a lot of our mortuary work, she will then, the family will bring all mum's makeup in or the daughter's makeup, and they will all together actually dress mum, do her hair, her makeup, and they walk out of there feeling they've really had a most important part to play, and they've basically seen what happens behind the scenes. They see that there's nothing hidden, there's nothing secret that goes on, and in a time of grief, and especially if it's a sudden unexpected death, I really do think that eases the pain a lot for the family, because they've been in, they've dressed, they've actually they've handled their loved one, and they walk out of there feeling they've been a major part of that final journey.
Trish, could you comment on that?
I think it's really important to give people the option to do that if they want to. But for some people, they may not be able to. It may be too difficult to do that. So open as an option, and people choose.
Can I share my little experience on that? My partner, when he died in 1995, they had an open coffin funeral. And we were actually on holidays when he died, so we wasn't in Melbourne. And we were both the same size, everything. And I just bought this really expensive shirt. Okay. So he died in hospital and it was a long death. It lasted for 2 weeks. And so the undertaker came and they took the body, and somebody, I think it was his mother or somebody, said, give him some nice clothes to wear so we can put him in the coffin. And he went up to view the body and he had my shirt on. And that's all I could think of. The whole funeral, my $249 shirt is in there. And I thought, can I go and ask the undertaker after the funeral, can you take that? I thought, no, I can't do that, can I?
Adam.
But it was, it cost me.
Adam.
I was bereft. There's people out
there go, oh my Adam.
I was mortified.
I was going to say maybe you were distracting Adam from your loss.
No, I wasn't.
No, it's just Adam. Can I ask then, how is that in relation to somebody suffering, my words have gone, a physical trauma with the body is disfigured? Do people then feel that they can or they can't, or they should or they shouldn't? People say, oh, no, you shouldn't see them if they've been in, say, a car accident.
In the situation of a car accident or a murder, and we've seen some horrific body damage with these different circumstances, they will say to us, usually they're guided by us. Yeah. I mean, if someone is viewable, and I always take it on, is if it would be me going to view one of my loved ones. So if they are totally viewable, we would say to the family, yes. If we think that it's going to be absolutely too devastating, you've usually sort of tuned into how the family's feeling, yeah, which isn't too good anyway, but to exactly where they might be at. If we think it's appropriate and we know that any reconstruction work we have to do and is going to be okay to view, we will say, look, we recommend that you do, or if you want to, you won't have a problem. But some are horrendous when we get them back into our care, especially maybe from a murder or, as I say, a motor accident. And we say straight to the families that, look, your loved one's just unviewable. But usually the coroner's involved prior to us, mm-hmm, and the coroner then, through identification, the family's got a fair idea of what's happening because they want DNA from the family, and they will actually say, look, you're unable to identify your loved
one. Peter, can I ask you a question to do with that? So in the situation of where there's been trauma or suicide, yes, with violent impact or something like that, the family actually still have to go and view the remains, do they?
Not so much now. No, look, the coronial services here in Victoria are absolutely excellent, and the backup service they provide for counselling and all sorts of things is extremely good. The family are usually fairly aware that their loved one will not be viewable.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that would be a horrific, horrifically traumatic situation, Trish.
I think if somebody did see someone who was totally, you know, matched unviewable, up, it can give the person post-traumatic stress, and they can see this, what they've seen, over and over and over again. It can cause them a lot more psychological distress than having to deal with the death itself.
Okay. There was a situation, a particularly bad traffic situation that happened in the front of a gay club a couple of years ago, which it terrified me. I thought if this poor guy was going, it was on Hoddle Street, and he tried to run across the traffic lights and he got hit by a car, but he was also beheaded.
Oh.
In the accident, he got beheaded. And I just thought, my goodness, the poor people. Then the people driving the car weren't speeding. They weren't doing anything wrong. Just this guy wasn't aware of the layout of the city. He was a visitor to Melbourne. And he tried to run across the road and he'd miscalculated and he got hit by the road. I just think about the poor people in the car, what they must have gone through when they hit this guy and he was beheaded.
And that's the same for the recent incident in Ascot Vale. There were innocent people in the cafe, mums with their kids and so forth. Are there services? Do people ring you? Or who do they ring and say, oh, I've seen this horrific thing? Who do they go to for support? Because they would be going through a process, indeed, as Adam said.
Well, if it's anything to do with a road traffic accident, there's a road trauma counselling service that people who are affected by road trauma can call up, and they can get some counselling around dealing with the trauma. And they don't have to be involved in the accident. They can witness it. So there's that. For suicide, there's a fantastic organisation called Support After Suicide. They're wonderful. They have lots of information. They have groups for people who've lost a loved one through suicide. They have counselling. And they're a wonderful resource that we've got in our community.
Is that Victoria or is it Australia-wide?
It's Victoria, I think. I'm not sure of the organisation's interstate. But Support After Suicide is Victoria, yes.
There's a lot of support mechanisms available for suicide across Australia. You just have to look on the internet. Now, I just wanted to explain and mention to the community why you don't hear a lot about suicide on the radio. We have an unspoken understanding in media. The reason we don't report every suicide is so that we don't set off copycat situations. you'll notice that there are actually a lot of suicides, and there are quite a lot in Melbourne. And there's a couple of places that seem to be favourite suicide locations, but you'll never hear them mentioned in the media because we don't want to give people information to help them commit suicide. Suicide is just such a waste of life. Look, sometimes life does become intolerable. I accept that for some people, but they're very, very extraordinary situations. This is why something like Joy 94.9 and the Community Radio Network is vitally important, because we reach out to our communities and say to you, the most important thing is you are not alone. Community radio will point to the place where you can belong. That sense of belonging is very, very important. Trish and Peter, I'd like to say to you a very special thank you for being a part of this special broadcast on the Community Radio Network about looking at death and dying. Mm. Trish, can you give us a quick message from your perspective as a bereavement and grief counsellor for the community?
I think following a loss, it just to be able to deal with a loss just takes the time it takes. And I have many people saying to me, look, my friends think I should have got over this by now. And this can be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years after the death. The thing is, we don't get over a death. We accept it. We integrate it into our being and who we are. And we're irrevocably changed by a close death. So it just takes how it takes. And people need ongoing support. And this can be from many, many months and for years. And the other thing is that people don't talk about the person who's died, and I think that's important when someone's died to talk about them.
Peter, would you like to give a quick message to the community as an undertaker?
Yes, look, I think if anyone that's thinking of wanting input into their funeral or anything like that, you can go and pre-arrange it. And anything basically that you want done these days can be done.
Peter and Trish, thank you very much for being part of Allegro Non Troppo here on the Community Radio Network. We'll be back again next week with Allegro Non Troppo. Sue, thank you.
Thank you, Adam.